Brings us now to our 21st presentation on the book of Revelation, and this is the 7:30 study period on Monday evening. Let's turn again to Revelation chapter 13. We closed our last study period with the consideration of the deceptive miracle-working power of Satan, with special reference to verse 14, where John the Beloved said that Revelation 13 and verse 14, where John the Beloved said, "And the devil deceiveth them that dwell upon the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast." And we're just beginning to examine some of the methods by which Satan makes it appear that he does accomplish great and fantastic miracles in the healing of the sick and the restoration of people who have been crippled or maimed or such like. Now I'd like to talk for a moment about the effect of tremendous fear upon the mind of a person and how this can produce what appears to be a miracle of conversion. I remember reading from the testimonies the story of a boat trip or a trip by ship down the east coast of America, I think from Portland, Maine to Boston, Massachusetts, or vice versa. And during the course of this journey, a tremendous storm blew up in the middle of the night and threatened the lives of all the people on board the boat. Now, before the storm came, the various folk on the boat were engaged in all kinds of worldly activities, dancing, drinking, gambling, and other things as well, no doubt. Then came the storm quite suddenly and unexpectedly. And while at first the passengers thought it was just a passing storm, they soon became aware of the fact that the ship was definitely threatened, and so were their lives. And as the storm grew wilder and wilder, tremendous fear entered the minds and hearts of these various passengers. What was the result? Amazing conversions took place that night. The gamblers stopped their gambling, the drinkers stopped their drinking, the dancers stopped their dancing. And they began to engage in prayer services and prayer meetings, and people bowed upon the ground, upon the deck I should say, or the floor, and they pled with God to save their lives and promised him that they would absolutely serve him for the rest of their days if only he'd save them from this tremendous storm. Now obviously at that point of time, the gamblers had lost all interest, totally lost all interest in gambling. It was no longer attractive to them in the least degree. And the drinkers had lost all interest in drinking, and the dancers likewise in their dancing. So there had been amazing conversions, very obviously. Well, in due time, thanks no doubt to the presence of Sister White and her group on board, enjoying God's special personal protection, the storm passed. And then the conversions were reversed again. Lightheartedly, the folk who had confessed their sins and promised to serve God reverted back to their old ways again and laughed at their former fears. In fact, Sister White tells how she addressed herself to one person going off the boat who was laughing at her former fears and rather sternly reminded her that there was a great judgment day coming, and she was despising the mercy of God at that point of time. Now, while those conversions were very brief, they were conversions. People turned away from their former practices to a life of prayer. But what was the factor which produced those conversions? Fear, right? Fear. Now sometimes the fear of judgment and coming destruction can work on a person's life, not just for a few short hours, as in the case of the story I just told to you, but actually for years and years and years, maybe of course for the remainder of a person's life. Not only fear, but the hope of a very, very great and wonderful reward. I think we'd safely say that those churches which try to obtain salvation by legalism, by keeping the works of the law, that those churches are ones in which the members are motivated more by fear on the one side and the hope of eternal reward on the other side, to make very interesting and long-lasting changes in the outward behavior patterns of their lives. Now another method which Satan uses, of course, is tremendous excitement. Now possibly you've read or maybe even attended, I hope not for your own sake, one of these modern revival sessions where the preachers concentrate on building up a tremendous enthusiasm and an intensive excitement. And this, of course, stimulates the adrenaline glands and the pituitary gland and fills the bloodstream with adrenaline. And people are able to do, in the excitement of the moment, tremendous things which they otherwise could not do. But once the excitement wears off, of course, they revert back to their previously crippled condition once again. And so by using laws available to him, Satan makes it appear that great and wonderful conversions have taken place among the people to whom he ministers. But when the excitement dies away, then the people are found in a worse state than before the supposed miracle took place. And never can the devil, of course, actually flow into the lives of those to whom he ministers the actual life-giving power which the God of heaven can and does flow into the lives of people. Let's notice the statement on page 261 in the book of the Writings, which talks about the delusive work of Satan and says that Satan, pleased with the deception, assumes a religious character and leads the minds of those professed Christians to himself, working with his power, his signs, and lying wonders to fast them in his snare. Some he deceives in one way and some in another. He has different delusions prepared to affect different minds. Some look with horror upon one deception while they readily receive another. Satan deceives some with spiritualism. He also comes as an angel of light and spreads his influence over the land by means of false reformations. The churches are elated and consider that God is working marvelously for them when it is the work of another spirit. And at this last sentence, the excitement will die away and leave the world and the church in a worse condition than before. The excitement will die away and leave the church, the world and the church in a worse condition than before. Now, why is this? Let's make now a comparison between the works of God and the works of Satan. We'll talk first of all about the works of God on the left-hand side of the board. Now, here is God, and together with him, of course, is Jesus Christ, the great connector between God and man. In the Desire of Ages, we're plainly told that in God and in Christ there is health and strength, and that the process by which the Lord God of heaven restores the sick spiritually, mentally, and physically is to flow that life out of himself. Let's talk of this in terms of an outflow out of God and an inflow into the needy person. I'll just use the word sick down here, but that covers, of course, spiritual, physical, and mental sickness as the case may be. So here is the sick person, and here then is this outflow of life which flows from God through Jesus Christ into that sick person. Now, it becomes very obvious, of course, that that sick person is receiving a supplement to what he already has. He's receiving something additionally. A gift of life is flowing into him. Let me read a statement or two from the book Ministry of Healing in this connection. I like very much the statement right on the very first page of the book Ministry of Healing, page 17, which talks about the procedure by which Jesus Christ brought healing to the sick in his and again in our own day. It talks about the fact that the burden of disease and wretchedness and sin he came to remove. It was his mission to bring to men complete restoration. He came to give them health and peace and perfection of character. Varied were the circumstances and needs of those who besought his aid, and none who came to him went away unhelped. From him, and note these words, from him flowed a stream of healing power, and in body and mind and soul men were made whole. Page 17 in the book Ministry of Healing. I like to compare that one with the statement of Desire of Ages, which gives to us the same very glorious and powerful message, across on page 825, I believe it to, no, 823. Page 823 in the book Desire of Ages. It's a comment on the statement, they shall lay hands on the sick and they shall recover. This world is a vast Lazar house, but Christ came to heal the sick, to proclaim deliverance to the captives of Satan. He was in himself health and strength. He imparted his life to the sick, the afflicted, those possessed of demons. He turned away none that came to receive his healing power. He knew that those who petitioned him for help had brought disease upon themselves, yet he did not refuse to heal them. And when virtue from Christ entered into these poor souls, they were convicted of sin, and many were healed of their spiritual disease as well as of their physical maladies. The gospel still possesses the same power, and why should we not today witness the same results? And that's the point very clearly then, that Jesus Christ was in himself health and strength, and he imparted his life to the sick, the afflicted, those possessed of demons. So here we find then that there is an addition, there is a charging of the human system with a fresh current of life. But then over here on the other hand, of course, we have the ministry of Satan. And the ministry of Satan, of course, unlike the ministry of God, does not flow from a fountain of life. Satan does not have in himself life and health as the Word of God says that Jesus Christ has. Here we find that in the Father and the Son there is life and there is health. So literally, when we come to God for healing from our physical maladies, the life and the health of Jesus Christ flows out of him and into that sick person. So the sick person then possesses the life and the health which previously was in Jesus Christ, and of course which is still there. Now when Satan works upon the human being, he must operate on the framework of laws. So here is the sick person, and all Satan can do is to stimulate what is already in the man and expend, or lead that man to expend what is in himself, so that man then is expending energy instead of receiving energy. Now, if he's expending energy instead of receiving it, then what's his condition going to be after the whole thing is over? He'll be weaker, he'll be in a worse state than he was before the supposed healing work came to him. And that's what we find in the book Early Writings, in a statement I read to you a few moments ago, that the excitement will die away and leave the church and the world in a worse state or in a worse condition than before. And there's the physiological reasons for that. Now, on the other hand, of course, if we have a person who is sick and then there flows into him the healing power of God, that man has got to be better off or in a better condition than he was before the healing ministry began. So Satan's ministry always leaves people in a worse state, but the ministry of Christ always leaves people in a much better state. We can rejoice to know, of course, that the gospel has lost none of its healing power, and therefore we can expect to see the same results today as were produced back in the days of Jesus Christ. Now, the whole purpose of this deceptive ministry on the part of Satan, of course, is to lead mankind to erect an image to the beast. Now, what action on the part of the peoples of this earth will establish the image to the beast? Precisely. When the Sunday law is made, the image of the beast will have been erected. Now, we need to appreciate the studies we had on Daniel just a year or so back now, in which we learned that there is a very definite parallel between the erection of the image of the beast, the erection of the image by Nebuchadnezzar back in the days of Daniel, and the establishment of the image down here in these last days. Let's just remind ourselves of one or two statements which confirm this fact from the Bible Commentary Volume 7, and comments, of course, on the Image of the Beast, page 976. The statement reads as follows: history will be repeated. False religion will be exalted. The first day of the week, a common working day, possessing no sanctity whatever, will be set up as was the image at Babylon. And that sentence, the first day of the week, a common working day, possessing no sanctity whatever, will be set up as was the image at Babylon. And let me add, for the very same reasons, on the very same basis. Let's just briefly go back and remember again the reasons why Nebuchadnezzar set up this great golden image on the plains of Jura. Nebuchadnezzar had built the kingdom of Babylon using what procedures? God's or man's? Man's procedures, right? In other words, it was a system where men sacrificed, or a man, Nebuchadnezzar namely, sacrificed other men's lives as much as was necessary to give to him world domination. It was the spirit of the papacy in as bad a form as it can be found. Now, a kingdom built by the sword will perish by the sword. There's nothing more certain than that. Those who reap oppression, those who reap force in order to gain wealth, riches, idleness, luxury and ease, are most certainly going to weaken themselves by the kind of life which they have instituted. And the weakness will not be fully apparent in the first generation. Nebuchadnezzar survived this reaction throughout the days of his life, especially, of course, because he became a true Christian anyway. But after his death and the reign of his son and grandson, Belshazzar, the evil seed sown, of course, came to full fruit, and a weakened Babylon was unable to withstand the onslaught of the Medo-Persians. Now, God came to Nebuchadnezzar at the height of his power, at the height of his confidence that Babylon would never pass away, but would be the grand kingdom lasting forever, and in the image demonstrated to him that Babylon would pass away and be supplanted by not one, but a number of kingdoms in their turn. Now, this meant then that a deadly blow was to be dealt against the principle of human problem solving, that man was not the master of his fate, but rather that man's own sinful ways were the master of him. And Nebuchadnezzar, even though at first he accepted this revelation from God, very soon reverted, and as a statement of his rejection of God's principles, he called for and built a great golden image upon the plains of Jura, and not being satisfied to simply make the statement, he was determined to enforce all men to underline the statement by bowing down and worshipping the great golden image. Now, the stand, of course, of Meshach, Shadrach and Abednego kind of took away the underlining, and King Nebuchadnezzar had to turn around and make a second confession that God's ways were right and true, and that Babylon would indeed pass away, and only God's kingdom would survive eternally. And in these last days, when the whole world finds itself confronted by problems which will require very extraordinary solutions, once again, Daniel, in the person of the people of this movement who have been prepared today to execute this mighty work, will be the means by which God will communicate to the world through the loud cry message the fact that kingdoms built on human plan-making will have certainly passed away as ancient Babylon did. The answer that the world will give to this will be to erect the image of the beast, just as Nebuchadnezzar did back in those days. The image of the beast, something which will be entirely of human devising, as was the great golden image, will be man's statement that kingdoms built by human power will last forever. They will point to their unity. They will point to their confederation of forces. They will point to the fact that they have one great spiritual leader. They will claim that they're doing all this for God, and they will say at that time that the little tiny minority, Daniel and his three friends once again, are too insignificant for their voice to be heard. And in defiance of the message given to the loud cry, to the latter rain, which will be the loud cry, they will erect this image of the beast, this child of the papacy, this Sunday law, as their statement that their kingdom will indeed last forever. And then they'll call upon the state to enforce the worship of this day, thereby demanding that the entire world shall underline or certify the truth of what they have done. In other words, they'll look to men to endorse or confirm that which God alone can endorse or confirm. Of course, God will never endorse or confirm the Sunday law, but God alone is the one to whom we should look for approval. But instead they'll look to human beings for approval. Let's read now further on page 976 of volume 7 of the Bible commentary, where I find these words: all nations and tongues and peoples will be commanded to worship the spurious Sabbath. This is Satan's plan to make of no account the day instituted by God and given to the world as a memorial of creation. The decree enforcing the worship of this day is to go forth to all the world. In a limited degree, it has already gone forth. In several places, the civil power is speaking with the voice of a dragon, just as the heathen king spoke to the Hebrew captives. History will be repeated, and obviously the better we understand the erection of the image back in the plains of Jura, the better we shall understand the erection of the great image which will be Sunday worship in the last days of human history. Now, coming on to verse 15, well, first of all we should say that the image will be an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. And which beast, of course, was that? The papacy, right? Papal Rome. And therefore, the image of the beast will be a reproduction of the papal principles through and through, which is much more than simply worshipping on the first day of the week. That worship, of course, is the symbol of everything which is papal, Babylonian, or Roman. Now, if you were asked to describe in one sentence, what is the identification or the identifying principle that makes the papacy to be the papacy? What would you say? It is the principle of man ruling over other men in the place of God, isn't it? That's the papacy. It is man out of his God-designed position. It is man usurping a place God never ever gave to him. Now, when apostate Protestantism arises to recognize the Pope of Rome as being the great problem solver, and therefore recognizes him as being God in the place of God, then what difference will there be between the Protestant system and the papal system? None whatsoever. It'll be the same thing through and through, and will bring upon the world the same dire consequences as did the papacy of old. Now we read in the 15th verse of this chapter, and he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Let's pause there a moment. Now, the onset of these restrictions and pressures on the part of the image of the beast will be progressive. I remember that when we were puzzling out the order of last day events quite a few years ago now, we had difficulty until we realized that point, and the key statement in regard to the order of last day events was found in a most surprising place, in the book Desire of Ages. Now, this is an unlikely place, we would think, to find a key statement solving the order of the last day events problem, but that's where we found it. Let's turn to the statement now on page 121 and 122 of the book Desire of Ages. This is a comment on the temptations of Christ in the mountain when Satan tempted him to turn the stones into bread. Page 121. Across to page 122, Desire of Ages. In the last great conflict of the controversy with Satan, those who are loyal to God will see every earthly support cut off. Because they refuse to break his law in obedience to earthly powers, they will be forbidden to buy or sell. It will finally be decreed that they should be put to death. Revelation 13:11-17. That's all it says. The rest of the paragraph now deals with promises that God's folk will not suffer hunger, although I shouldn't say not suffer hunger, but they will be protected. They will receive bread and water, which will be sure to them, although at times they will suffer hunger and delay, as Christ did, of course, upon the Mount of Temptation. But let's now analyze this statement as follows. It starts off by saying, because they refuse to break his law in obedience to earthly powers. Now, what law alone will God's people have trouble with? The Sunday law. When the law of the land says, thou shalt not kill, will we find it hard to obey?
the thing coming on? There's a copy of labor of yours. Right,
we have no trouble obeying the law which says thou shalt not kill or commit murder. But we have trouble obeying the law which says thou shalt not steal. No, we won't. So what law will we have trouble obeying? The Sunday law. Now that means then that our refusal to break God's law, to obey this law of the land, cannot take place until that law has been made. Because we'll have no trouble, obviously, over a law that doesn't exist. So therefore, the statement is working on the basis of the fact that the Sunday law has been passed, and therefore the image of the beast has been formed, and then when that law is made, then the people of God will disobey that law because it requires them to disobey the commandments of God. Now, because they refuse to break God's law in obedience to earthly powers, they will be forbidden to buy or sell. So very obviously then, of course, the buy and sell decree is not something which is written into the first or initial Sunday law which will be passed and which will set up the image of the beast back there at the beginning. In other words, first of all, the Sunday law is made. Later, then comes the disobedience on the part of God's people. Then comes the buy and sell decree. And then the statement goes on to say, it will finally be decreed that they shall be put to death. So then the death decree is still later. Let's put it over here. I don't have time this evening, but I think we all understand anyway that the death decree is made just before the close of probation. Although the date for its execution is placed at a later date, which turns out to coincide with the outpouring of the fifth and then the sixth and seventh plagues. So let this green line on the board tonight represent the close of probation, and a death decree is made just before that time comes and we enter into the time of Jacob's trouble. Now, of course, prior to the buy and sell decree, there's an increasing amount of pressure, persecutions and various troubles that are levelled against God's people. I'll read you just a little bit of that from the book Great Controversy this evening, where Sister White lists point by point the development of the persecution which were levelled against the people of God at this time. Great Controversy, page 606 and page 607. Now, first of all, the statement talks about the third angel's message being given with greatest power, which we know to be during the loud cry period, God working through humble instruments, the labours being qualified by the Holy Spirit instead of by literary institutions, and then the message going forth. And it says then that thousands upon thousands will listen who have never heard words like these. In amazement they hear the testimony that Babylon is the church, fallen because of her errors and sins, because of her rejection of the truth sent to her from heaven. As the people go to their former teachers with eager inquiry, are these things so? The ministers present fables, prophesy smooth things to soothe their fears, and quiet the awakened conscience. So the very first measures made against the people of God are smooth sayings designed to pacify and quieten down the excitement and inquiry raised because of the preaching of the message in latter rain power. We realize, don't we, of course, that the latter rain falls when the Sunday law is passed. It's when the sins of Babylon have reached unto heaven that God comes through his answer and the latter rain falls and the loud cry begins. Now, when the Sunday law is first passed, the people of God are not the subject of that law. It is not made because of them. Because at that time, we will still be a very insignificant people, unknown to either the Catholics or the Protestants. A very little group of people as we still are. And the Sunday law will be passed as a human solution to the complicated and deep-seated problems which will be possessing the earth at that time. And the argument will be that the earthquakes and tidal waves and storms and conflagrations and wars and terrorism and rioting and all that sort of thing will not be stopped until God is respected and his day is upheld. In their minds, of course, Sunday being that day. So it will not be against God's people that the Sunday laws be primarily passed. But when they are passed, and the mighty outpouring of the latter rain comes, and the loud cry begins, then the people of God will expose the iniquitous consequences of making that law, and will demonstrate that the making of it will bring the whole land to total, absolute, and final ruin. Now, when the ministers find that their efforts to quiet the awakened conscience are unsuccessful, then they are roused to much more intense and bitter opposition, as I shall now read. But, this is page 607, Great Controversy, but since many refuse to be satisfied with the mere authority of men and demand a plain, thus saith the Lord, the popular ministry, like the Pharisees of old, filled with anger as their authority is questioned, will denounce the message as of Satan, and stir up the sin-loving multitude to revile and persecute those who proclaim it. Now this is not yet the buy and sell decree. This is general persecution, which becomes more and more intense as time goes by, as the next paragraph now demonstrates. As the controversy extends in the new fields, and the minds of the people are called to God's downtrodden law, Satan is astir. The power attending the message will only madden those who oppose it. The clergy will put forth almost superhuman efforts to show away the light, lest it should shine upon their flocks. By every means at their command, they will endeavour to suppress the discussion of these vital questions. The church appeals to the strong arm of civil power, and in this work, Papists and Protestants unite. As the movement for Sunday enforcement becomes more bold and decided, the law will be invoked against commandment keepers. And what does the word invoke mean? Pardon? Not quite enforced. The first part of the word in means in. The second part comes from the Latin. No, it's already passed. The law will be invoked. The second part comes from the Latin derivation voco, I call, literally means to call in. Right? So the law will be called in against commandment keepers. The law will be already existent. It will have been passed and made back here, but we're now moving on down toward the buy and sell decree. So this law, which back here is not made against commandment keepers, will now be called in and used against them. It will have been conveniently passed and will be used against them. Now, when it is, at this stage, we will see what now happens. They will be threatened with fines and imprisonment, and some will be offered positions of influence and other rewards and advantages as inducements to renounce their faith. Now, I suggest at this point that the buy and sell decree has not yet been passed, because what's the point in threatening a person with a fine if he can't buy and sell? What's the point? Which is the greater measure, a fine or a prohibition against buying and selling? Right, that's the greater measure, isn't it? So therefore, the buy and sell decree has not yet been passed. Now, I'd like to mention this point, that some will be offered positions of influence and other rewards and advantages as inducements to renounce their faith. This is a very, very clever trick which Satan uses very successfully against some people. More than once we've seen people who have listened to this message. I'm thinking, for instance, of one family over in the Walla Walla area at the moment. And 2 years ago, the head of the house and his wife were absolutely enthralled with the presentations of bondage to freedom and the character of God, righteousness by faith, justification by faith, and so forth. And at that time, they were working outside of Adventist employment. We're most welcome in their home, and they look forward to our coming back next year. They plan to come to camp meeting. In fact, the man of the house even asked me, could he travel across America with me and go to all the camp meetings during his vacation period. Everything looked extremely promising. Then a few weeks later, the Seventh-day Adventist Church came and offered him a very, very fine position in one of their large institutions. Well, this man didn't stop to think too much, I suppose, but he regarded this as being a wonderful move on God's part, a great blessing which he couldn't possibly turn his back on. He accepted the position. We came back to America last year expecting to find him just as enthusiastic as previously, but now his head was all full of negative attitudes and questions about the character of God and justification by faith, And we recognized that now he was in the Seventh Adventist Church's employ, and he was a very loyal Seventh Adventist. Now, and I've seen this happen more than once. Again and again and again I've seen it happen since this message first came to us. Now, curiously enough, the church never, ever, or Satan never comes to a person who is really firm in this message and offers that person that position of advantage and influence. Ever since I became a problem to the Adventist Church back in 1958, 62, 61, they were quite happy, I think, to have me resign from my position in the college, and never once since that day they offered me any kind of position whatsoever. They know perfectly well, of course, it wouldn't attract me in the slightest, because I'm fully aware that it's better to walk in isolation and separation with Christ than to be with the multitude to do evil. But it'll be successful once again with people during the loud cry period. But as we read on, their steadfast answer is, as the true people of God, show us from the word of God our error. The same plea that was made by Luther under similar circumstances. Those who are arraigned before the court make a strong vindication of the truth, and some who hear them are led to take their stand to keep all the commandments of God. Thus light will be brought before thousands who otherwise would know nothing of these truths. Now I read these papers, and there's much more of this chapter yet, of course, which talks about fearful persecution, the approaching storm, the abandonment of the faith by many thousands of people, and then the final climactic pressure brought upon them by the death decree, when they seem to be threatened with destruction, or when they are threatened with destruction. But the point I want to demonstrate is this, that the enforcement of the image of the beast is a progressive work. The full weight and pressure does not come at the very beginning. At the very beginning of this, Satan and the churches get as strong a Sunday law as they can at that point of time. Now, when that Sunday law is passed, and this mighty protest is leveled against the breakers of the Sunday law by the people of God, then those people, the people of God, become the scapegoat then for all the troubles which are happening in the world. In other words, you and I will be the scapegoats. And the churches will say, aha, now we see surfacing the real cause of our troubles. This people who will not conform, who will not go along with this grand scheme. And when the whole world then has a scapegoat for their troubles, then this gives the church the chance to make the Sunday law even stiffer and put teeth into it to give it more pressure power against the people of God. And so the pressure mounts from the Sunday law to persecution, to fines and imprisonment, to the buy and sell decree, and at last the death decree. Now those who eventually pass the death decree are the ones who receive the seal of the living God. Let me close with a statement from the Bible commentary once more, where we're told in very clear terms that the image of the beast constitutes the test which we must all endure before we can receive the seal of the living God. Page 976 in volume 7. The Lord has shown me clearly that the image of the beast will be formed before probation closes, for it is to be the great test for the people of God by which their eternal destiny will be decided. This is a test that the people of God must have before they are sealed. All who prove their loyalty to God by observing his law and refusing to accept a spurious Sabbath will rank under the banner of the Lord God Jehovah and will receive the seal of the living God. Those who yield the truth of heavenly origin and accept the Sunday Sabbath will receive the mark of the beast. Now, in this passage, of course, Revelation 13, 11 to 17 is quoted, and it is when we pass the full test on the image of the beast, which will not be until the death decree is passed, then we get the seal of the living God and pass into the time of Jacob's trouble to fight the final battle and gain the final victory. Well, time has gone again so soon, so we must stop at this point. Are there any questions you'd like to ask in regard to this particular study presentation?